Very good. Anyway, the Gilayon for this week is in Lech Lecha, Parshat Lech Lecha, and it's about announcing Yitzchak's impending birth. And it's a bit challenging in the sense that Nechama wades into areas which she doesn't always deal with, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit. But meanwhile, the psukim that are relevant are on page one of the answer sheets at the bottom. Vayhi Avram ben tishim shana v'teisha shanim. He was 99. Vayira Hashem el Avram. God appears to him. Vayomer elav ani kel shakai. Hitalech lefanai v'yei tamim. Walk before me and be tamim. Hitalech lefanai is compared or contrasted with Noach, where Noach is supposed to walk with God. Avram is supposed to walk in front of God. And that was the topic of what I wrote about today. V'etna briti b'ni u'b'necha, and I will make my covenant between me and between you. V'arbe otach b'mo'ov ma'od, I will multiply you greatly. V'yipol Avram al panav, v'yidaber ito elokin le'mor. Avram falls on his face, God speaks with him. Ani hine briti itach, my covenant is with you. V'yiti la'av hamon goyim. V'yita la'av, and you will be a father of a multitude of nations. Lo yikare olet shimcha Avram, your name now will change from Avram. V'yash shimcha Avraham, ki av hamon goyim netaticha. The extra hey seems to fit into this idea that you are now a father of many nations. To my mind, that's a universalistic theme, not just the particularistic theme, and that's important. If reiti otach b'mod ma'od, and I will make you fruitful very much, v'netaticha l'gayim, and you will become nations, m'lachim imcha yetzeo, and there will be kings from you, v'akimoti abriti b'ni u'b'inach, b'in zarech acharecha, there will be my covenant between me and between you, your children after you, ludorotam, for generations, lebrit olam, for an eternal covenant, yod lecha elohim, to be for you a god, lezarecha acharecha, as well as for your offspring after you. V'natati lecha lezarecha acharecha, eight eretz mgurecha, and I will give you also the land where you're sojourning, I call eretz kanan lachuzat olam, it will be a holding, an eternal holding, v'yiti lehem le'elohim, and I will be for you a god. Right? V'yomer elohim el avram, ata briti tishmor, you will keep my covenant. Atav zarecha acharecha ledoratam, you and your children after you forever. Zod briti asher tishmu beni beinechem bein zarecha acharechem himolachem kol zachar. So circumcision. The maltimet kol b'sar alatchem v'hayal od brit beni beinechem will be a sign of a covenant. This is sort of same thing we saw with the keshet. There is an ambiguity about, is it a covenant or is it a sign of a covenant? In other words, isn't the sign of a covenant not the covenant itself? And it's not really clear what the relationship is from these psukim, but that's not our topic.
By the way, by word of explanation, I want to point out that's also true in the law with regard to contracts. Like, yeah, people think, like, the written contract is the contract. No, may not so. Mm-hmm. It's really just evidence of a contract. Mm-hmm. But the contract can be burned, mm-hmm, and the contract can still exist.
I understand. So, mm-hmm, so it's an idea.
Yes.
Uben shmonat yamim yimol lachem kol zachar ledorotechem, so it's 8 days. Yilid bayit miknat kesev mikol ben nechar. So it's not only the people who are part of your house, but also people who are your possession, your slaves, if you like. Any male asher lo mizaracha who is not of your family. Yimol yimol yilid beitcha miknat kaspecha, so they will surely be circumcised. Vayita briti b'sarchem lebrit olam. My covenant will be with your flesh forever. Yar lo zachar asher lo yimol et b'sar latov v'nechrotah nefesh ahi me'ameha et briti hefar, if someone doesn't do it, so kared is involved. Vayomer Elokim el Avram, Sarai yishtecha lo tikra et shema Sarai, so now I'm changing not only Avram's name, but Sarah's name as well, ki sarashma, uveirachti ota, and I will bless her, v'gam natati mimeno lecha bein, and through her you will have a child. He's already had a child through Hagar, but now he's going to have a child through Sarah. Verachtia vaita l'gayim, I will bless her, she will be for nations, malchei amim mimena yiyu. So that parallels what he had said to Avram, that nations will come from him and there will be kings, so also nations will come from Sarah and there will be kings. Vayipol Avram apanav vayitzchak, so here's the basis for the name. So Avram falls on his face and he laughs, vayomer b'libo, and he says in his heart, halavein mea shana yivale, really? Will someone who's 100 years old have a child? V'im Sarah habat tishim shana yeteled, and Sarah, if she's 90, will she have a child? Which implies a similar skepticism to what Sarah explains, and yet Sarah is the one who's confronted, and Avram is not. So that's a topic the Mefarshim talk about. So now I'd like to go to the Alon Hadracha. which is on the third page in my version of the printout. It's also on page 5 of the answer pages, because I noted that it doesn't print out entirely straight from it, so therefore if you want to follow it on page 5 of the answer page, you can do that. So first she talks about the things that are the essence of the perek that she's not going to talk about. Okay, so we'll start with the second paragraph. Hashela HaRishona, the first question of the Gilayon, and we'll look at page 1 in a second, Oseket Binyan HaGadol Asher Hevich Rabim Michokrei HaMikra, a very big topic that has caused confusion amongst many scholars of the Bible text. Evi'am livnot binyanim gedolim atluyim al blima. There she's giving her evaluation of this. And they've built all sorts of structures that are built on nothing, that are, you know, what she considers silly. Hu inyan shinui hashemot elokiyim batorah, the change of names in the Torah about God. God's name is inconsistent. We'll look at question number 1 and then give context of what she's talking about. Question number 1 in the Gilayon, on the first page of the Gilayon, it says, Vayipol Avram al panav v'idaber ito Elokim le'mor. Avram falls on his face and God speaks with him, saying, and the term that's used is Elokim. Mm-hmm. So the Malbim writes, Zeh ha'pam harishon shenizkar b'dibur Hashem al Avram Hashem Elokim. This is the first time that when Hashem speaks with Avraham, the name Elohim is used. Well, that's something that, you know, should be looked upon. So if you look on page 2 of the answer page, so here is, you know, the how Hashem addresses Avraham prior to this point and how he addresses him after this point. So at the top of the page, in Breshit Yudbet, Vayomer Yudkevavke al Avram. Vayira Yudkevavke al Avram. Right? So in chapter 12, the two times that God is mentioned, you have the tetragrammaton. In chapter 13, Vyudkevavke Omar al Avram. Once again, it's the tetragrammaton. In chapter 15, it says Yudkevavke, 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 Yudkevavke. Right? So therefore, as the Malbim points out, until this point, the tetragrammaton is the term that's used for God when there is a conversation between God and Avraham. But from this point on, and now you see under the line that I drew over here on the second page of the answers, every time it's the term Elohim. So, so back to the Malbim. So, in fact, what the Malbim says is correct. In other words, we've seen that his summary of this turn from Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei to Elohim is in fact so. Ki shem Elohim mitzanuhu mitzuraf el briotav. The term Elohim, we have found, is connected to God's creations. Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yisrael. In other words, that's a smichut. So we don't find the term Elohim alone, we find it as the God of Elokei so-and-so. Mashaloma tzanu kein b'yeter shemot. We don't find that kind of construction by the other names that are used for God. We don't find Yud Kei Vav Kei Yaakov or something like that. We don't find the tetragrammaton of Yaakov. Tetragrammaton stands on its own, but the term Elokim can be constructed syntactically as part of a smichut, a dependency where it's the God of. Sheyesh elokut hamit pashetet bechlal habriya, that there is a godly idea that stretches throughout the creation. Shemitzad zeh nikra elokei olam. So I can talk about elokei Abraham, elokei Yitzhak, elokei Yaakov, or elokim, or elokei olam. That is talking about the impersonal God that relates to the creation and the creatures in that creation. Ushem elokim. Similarly, when you look in Bereshit chapter 1, it is Elohim all of the time. All of the things that are mentioned there are in terms of the term Elohim. We said last time that according to the Rabbanel, there is even the Brit that was established about the rules of nature, that the water should only go up to here and not past that, etc. V'yesh elukut hachala al kol ish hamuchan laze al pi hachanato kemo ha'avot. So there is Elohim on the one hand, which is the impersonal God of nature. There is also Elohim who communicates with people through nevuah, like the forefathers, asher shachan aleihem ha'elokut, that Elokut dwells upon them, be'inyan acher nizgav min ha'elokut hanimtza b'teva, in somehow an exalted fashion, more exalted than the general Elokut that applies to nature. So in that respect, he wants to claim that Elohim here is implying a certain kind of relationship with Abraham. It seems to me the counterintuitive, because it would sound, usually Yudke Vavke is considered the more personal kind of God, and therefore if you're talking about a relationship between God and a person, I would expect Yudke Vavke, which is in fact the case in all of the psukim leading up to our chapter. But in our chapter, it switches to Elohim. And the Malbim, I think, has to stretch a little bit in order to try to make sense of that.
Well, it also strikes me as, I can't quite get my head around it, because the Tetragrammaton is Midat Rachamim, personal, which connotes more of a personal connection.
Correct.
And for something like this,
in
particular, whereas Elohim is Midat Hadin, and why? What's the shaychut? What's the relevance of Midat Hadin to this particular?
Yeah, I don't think that the Malbim has necessarily explained the dynamic of the relationship. He is just sort of defining it. However, I think that he is defining it almost like after the fact. I think that the question is better than the answer. Why doesn't Yudke Vavke continue in the verses that deal with the impending birth of Yitzchak? Why do we revert to Elohim? So, Casuto, Umberto Casuto, who is a relatively modern Italian biblical critic, and who is one of Nechama's go-to people.
It's a bit of a surprise.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, he had a lot of bones to pick with Standard.
Yeah. Sure. Well, that's perhaps why she liked it. Anyway, I'll talk about that in a second. So he writes, and this is from a lengthy description from a book that's called The Documentary Hypothesis. In other words, he wrote a book specifically trying to refute Wellhausen and that whole theory. B'shem Hashem, Bachra HaTorah. I'm reading still on page 1 of the Gilayon, in the next section. The Torah chooses Yudke Vavke, Keshemedubar El Elokei Yisrael B'yachas La'amo. When it's talking about the God of Israel vis-a-vis his people. If that's the case, I would have expected Yudke Vavke to talk about Yitzchak, because that's his people. O la'avotav shel amo.
I didn't follow that. Why?
In other words, if he's saying Yudke Vavke is used when it refers to specifically the Jewish people, well, what is more about the Jewish people than Avram having a child who's going to carry on the traditions of Avram? That's the Jewish people. And so therefore, I would have expected Yudke Vavke to be used there.
Right, and ironically, the whole parak about Yishmael uses Yudke Vavke, and it's the parak about Yitzchak that uses
Yudke. Okay, so that even aggravates it more. Ola avotav shelamo. Or it could also be the fathers of the nation. Well, Yitzchak is one of the fathers of the nation. Ubeshem Elokim, keshemedubar al ha'elokut biyachatz lemi she'eino shayach la'am ha'nivchar. Elokim is used with regard to godly matters of people who are not pertinent to the chosen people. So, again, that would seem to not help us in the particular passage that we're dealing with.
But there are other counterexamples to that principle anyway, like the pasuk, Anachi Elokei Avicha, and things like that. So, what do you make of that?
I understand. There's a problem. And this is the basis of the documentary hypothesis. In other words, that because you cannot come up, well, at least some people said, you cannot come up with a rationale that will explain why certain terms switch from one to the other, particularly the name of God. So therefore, this is evidence of separate documents that have been redacted together at some point in time. I mean, that's really what higher criticism talked about.
I think Malbim was trying to speak to Jonathan's point by saying that Elohim has two usages, right? It has the regular usage and the, like, nismach usage to a person, and that's
but
two
that's still
things.
I think that's still difficult.
Right. No,
and
it's certainly
appears,
forced.
For example, when Hashem talks to Moshe, he says, I'm going to feel okay with
right.
Here,
so,
he
right.
doesn't say that.
Right.
So he's sort of adding a new, kind of almost like a new name of God. There's Elohim, and then there's Elohim
okay,
X.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And then she writes, V'ayin dvara ba'arichut.
But it's actually grammatically impossible. Well, not impossible. It doesn't cling to have a smichut with the Yud Kei Vav.
Right. It doesn't
correct,
make sense.
Because Yud Kei Vav Kei is a proper name, right? It's the name that
right.
we give God, as opposed to Elohim, which just means God,
which
right?
Is
which is why
noun.
The word Elohim is used
that's
for other gods.
It's not
as
a
well.
Proper noun, it's a noun.
Right.
So anyway, she writes, V'ayin dvara ba'arichut ba'alon hadracha. And in the Alon Hadracha, she quotes Kasuto extensively. Mm-hmm. And that is, in my version, the third and the fourth pages of the Gilayon, or if you want, you can look at, again, pages 5 and 6 on the answer sheet where I reprinted it because the whole thing doesn't come out. And so here is an extensive discussion by Kasuto. And as a little bit of background, as we have been saying, Kasuto is reacting to the documentary hypothesis. The documentary hypothesis essentially, well, the purest form of it, essentially argued that there were four texts that you could identify. There's even a polychrome version of the Bible where each pasuk is presented in a different color based upon this idea. And there is the J source, which is Yudke Vavke. Mm-hmm. There is the source, Elohim. There is what's called the Deuteronomist, that Devarim was considered a separate thing. And this leaks out into some of the other books beyond Devarim. And then there's the priestly source. And it's assumed that these were also chronological. So therefore, when there was an attempt to stress the role of the Kohanim, so therefore a different text was brought together in order to be able to promote ritual and promote their position, etc. And this was a theory that was developed in the 18th and 19th century. Kasuto shows that it was applied, it was not unique to the Bible, but it was applied to like Homer's work and other things. In other words, the assumption is that people were superstitious and assumed that things were of a piece, when in fact, when you do scholarly analysis, scientific analysis of these texts, you will find inconsistencies or repetitions or things like that. And those things indicate that there is an inconsistency within the text. And there are different theories. There was also a theory that it started out with as a particular text that was augmented over time as opposed to something like this. But meanwhile, these are the main theories. And Kasuto,
know how everyone, those of us that are older, kids.
That's a
compliment. Keep going.
No,
take the foot out of your mouth.
Just talk for a second. Where you were when you heard that John F. Kennedy was shot. I actually remember very dramatically the first time, like where I was as Yeshiva Bachar, when I heard the theory of that there are four authors of the Torah. Wow! No, it was like a really.
Right. I think so. And it blows up.
And it was a magnificent intellectual experience.
I'm sure it was, but it's also something that undermines people's emunah.
Obviously.
Yes, well, but that's.
But I heard it from a frum person.
A frum person who was using it?
But it was a scholar.
Oh.
So he was talking about.
Well, like,
and I was with Danny Matt actually when I said, "Hey, what do you think of this?"
Right. Well, anyway, people like Mordechai Breuer used it and tried to explain how you can hold things like this and still believe that the Torah is of a piece, etc. Anyway, I just wanted to mention, this is a really good book, which I like very much, and I've reviewed it and gotten into a controversy with someone about it, but also called Torah and Western Thought, and it's 10 essays about great people of the 20th century who... this is Meir Soloveitchik and Stuart Halper and Shlomo Zukir, who's in here... Rav Cook, Rav Herzog, Rav Soloveitchik, Aaron Soloveitchik, Jacobowitz, Rabbi Lamb, Rav Amital, Dr. Twersky, and Rav Aaron. And there's also an essay about Nachama Leibowitz by Yael Unterman, who wrote that magnificent biography about her. Anyway, so she writes in one section of this essay, Professor Leibowitz's closest peers tended to be those whose views of the Torah combined a fairly traditional approach, especially with regard to authorship, with an interest in text rather than realia. These included Israeli scholars hailing from strongly traditional backgrounds, such as Umberto Casuto, Moshe Tzvi Segal, Martin Buber, Yechezkel Kaufman, and Meir Weiss. However, she also demonstrated an affinity for the commentaries of Benno Yaakov, Benno Jacob, a Reform rabbi. She strongly preferred the literary approach espoused by Jacob, Casuto, Buber, Rosenzweig, and Weiss over any biblical critical approach. In fact, she had more in common with the non-Orthodox Buber than she did with her Orthodox colleague, Rabbi Mordechai Breuer. The latter reported that on the occasion of the first public presentation of his theory, Professor Leibowitz was his fiercest opponent. His attempts to incorporate biblical critical theories in ways consonant with Orthodox sensibilities was not at all to her liking. To his chagrin, she did not budge from this position throughout her lifetime. Her years of immersion in biblical criticism in German universities have left her with the impression that such interpretations were frequently tendentious, driven by anti-Semitism and erroneous, exhibiting a profound ignorance of... exhibiting a profound ignorance of Hebrew and of the only authentic context for reading the Bible, the moral ethical one. Thus, for example, she writes, "We shall decline to follow that non-Jewish commentator who endeavored to trace Jacob's limp after the wrestling bout with the angel to an attack of rheumatism caused by sleeping in the open all night in the damp atmosphere of the brook. Such a mechanical approach to supernatural mystical events must be ruled out in favor of the primary demand of interpretation, response to the spirit, tone, and intention of the narrative."
The Hollywoods would not have liked Velikovsky.
No, she wasn't into that. Anyway, so that's why it's interesting that she should even take this on. In other words, this whole issue of the different names of God is an issue which is very much in the bailiwick of biblical criticism. Mm-hmm. And so she will trot out Casuto in order to be able to give a rational approach which is still traditional in her mind and will not fall prey to this, you know, untraditional sort of approach. So you have that, the line that was quoted in the Gilayon, and that line in my version, in my printout of the Alon Hadracha, is really towards the end, towards the bottom of the page. You see, B'Shem Hashem Kishvuar al Eile Yisrael, Elokei Yisrael, B'yachas le'amo olavotav shalamo. That's the, that was the quote that was made. But there's a whole bunch of stuff before that, right? So I'll read a little bit of it. So starting in the middle of the page in my version, Al Yisod Masha Amarnu Adkan, Rishaim Anachnu Lachshov, based on what we've said until now, it is proper for us to think, Shebechol Mikre U'Mikre, Bachra HaTorah, Be'echad Mishnei HaShemot, Lefi HaTochen, Lefi HaKavana. This isn't about separate documents. It's all a function of the content and the intent. So therefore, one name or the other will be deliberately chosen as a result of the context. V'davka kidlakaman. And here are the rules. So he has, you know, a number of postulates. Barcha b'shem Hashem, Yudkei Vavkei, k'shemishtakef b'dvareha musak ha-yisraeli shel elokut, when there is the Jewish version of what God is about. Hamidgashem b'tmunat Hashem, which is concretized in the image of God, v'hamidbate b'midotav, and that is expressed through his attributes, hamuskamot v'amukubalot b'Yisrael, that are agreed to and accepted by Israel, u'b'yichud b'ofav hamusari, especially when it comes to ethical issues. B'midotav u'bachra b'shem Elokim, that name is chosen, k'shemishtakev b'dvareha musag hamufshat, the abstract idea, shelhu elokut ha-revach, revach b'chugim ha-bein lu'umim, which you can find in universal groups, shel ba'alei ha-chachma, of sages, wise men, musag ha-kel ha-murgash ba'ofan klali, the concept of God that is presented in a general way, ki yotzer ha-olam ha-chumri, who has created the physical world, k'manhig ha-teva u'kemor mekor ha-chayim. B'shem Hashem, Yudkei Vavkei, we'll just read one more, k'shah ba'al lidei bitui, when it, that is expressed, otah tfisash ha-yishira va-intuitivit, the intuitive, straight idea, shel helokut shehi ofyanit le'emunato ha-tmima shel hamon ha'am, which is unique to the basic belief of the proletariat, o lehit lahavuta shel haruach ha-nevuit, or through the fiery aspect of the prophetic spirit. U'b'shem Elokim, b'sheba'a lidei bitui, when that is used, k'tfisatam shel hogei ha-deot ha-manyanim ha-mitbonenim al ha-ba'ayot ha-nizgabot shel ha-viyat ha-olam ve-ha-noshut, when you're dealing with the problems of the world and the problems of human nature. So again, I mean, he has a whole hypothesis here about which term is used and why. It doesn't necessarily help us in terms of our issue, in terms of, so why is Elohim specifically connected to the birth of Yitzchak? And perhaps you could say that since what's going on here is that this is the biological continuation of Avraham, in other words, yes, it might, Yudkei Vavkei might be used by Yishmael, but Yishmael isn't really, from God's point of view, Avraham's son, or isn't the continuation of the Jewish people. However, where does Avraham really reproduce himself? He reproduces himself through Yitzchak, and perhaps the term Elohim is used there in the sense of some sort of universal, some sort of, you know, very, very basic idea. But again, I think the question is better than the answer.
I wonder if it has something to do with Brit Milah, because when Yitzchak is born, it says Vashem Pakadatzar, right? He uses Yud Kei Vav Kei, but then when he gives the Brit Milah in Pasuk Dalet and Paruch Havalef, it says Vayamal Avram Ed Yitzchak Beno Ben Shmona Yamim Kasher Tziva Oto Elokim. So I wonder
the beginning of the covenant.
Yeah, because that's where it switches, right? It switches when it starts talking about Brit Milah. That's where.
And
it
which
switches.
Term was used when the Brit was made with Noah, that we talked about last week?
All right, that's a good question.
So maybe it's a Brit issue.
Yeah. So it's definitely Elohim in the beginning of Noah,
right.
And let's see, Bahakimodi Briti, right? So. I mean, it doesn't actually say Hashem because he's in the middle of speaking,
right.
But it says Vayomer Elohim Lanoah, and then it's all part of the speech.
Okay.
So maybe there's another speech after it comes out of the ark.
Right. So is that also Elohim? Yeah, it's also Elohim. Vayomer Elohim Lanoah, Tevin HaTeva.
So maybe there's some.
What happens with Din versus Rachamim?
Yeah.
I mean,
and some.
There's
yeah.
This whole period of, you know, a Noah of this intense Din. And then Brit is also about. You know, a test, a din. I mean, there's also a din element to it.
Sure, but none of them have talked about din and rachamim.
No,
I mean, that's a rabbinic idea.
Yeah.
They're talking more, at least Kasuto is, of very, very general terms as far as universal versus particularistic. And I think that is borne out in many, many contexts. Although, as Jonathan says, there might be exceptions.
It also says Elohim when they get the Torah, and Hashem says Brit, right? Moshe Allah Elohim. No, but it says both. Vayikra Elav Hashem and Ahar.
So it might be that, you know, if you say Al Shlosha Dvarim Ha'olam Omed, or, you know, Yom HaShishi, you know, Hitna Tnayim Ma'aseh Breishit, there was a condition with Ma'aseh Breishit, if Bnei Yisrael accept the Torah, then everything goes okay. then it might be that the particular actually is universal in the sense that the particular is justifying the universal, that through the Brit and through the Torah and through Noach, this isn't just a Yud Kei Vav Kei Jewish people issue. This is actually an issue for the whole world. And by Yom Ahu Yeh Hashem Echad U'Shmo Echad, maybe it supports the whole idea of Or L'Goyim and all these other kinds of classical ideas. It's not clear.
When you say that, it's like you're really pointing out that these two theories, the ones that we're talking about, are so big that you could stuparain any sort of drashla.
Okay.
I mean it. It's like so un...
What's the alternative? And there's that you can, you know, if you're going to say that there are, I mean, this isn't only the way biblical stuff is done. This is the way all science or anything is done. What you do is, as it was taught to me when I was, a freshman in college, that there are phenomena. You look at the phenomena and try to come up with a hypothesis. You develop experiments to try to test the hypothesis. Either the hypothesis passes the test or it doesn't. If it passes the test, then that is a support to the hypothesis. And if it doesn't, you have to go back and find new hypotheses that will help. So this is part of the process of study. So you're right. It could be that this is too general. But no, then you have to bring a counterexample.
I was attacking you because what you just said was, you know, even though this is a particularistic theory, so the particularism has in it an implication of universalism.
Well, and I'm not just saying that. I believe that.
And it's a very profound religious concept, but to work it backwards and try to say that's reflect... Huh?
And the Bible critics are a lot more far-fetched.
Okay. Well said.
If you read who wrote the Bible, what's his name? Robert Freeman, whoever the author was there.
That's Kugel, huh?
No, it's not Kugel. Anyway, he says, I couldn't even believe he said this, so he's assuming Hashem is this more imminent name and Elohim is this more transcendent name, and the entire theology of immanence and transcendence was accidentally created by the redactor, right? Because there was one group that believed in God's immanence and one group that believed in God's transcendence, and then the redactor stuck them together and the entire Judeo-Christian theory was created by accident.
That's one of the critiques of the biblical, this is the Wikipedia article, and it's rather extensive, and it has a section of weaknesses in the documentary hypothesis, and it says... this one person, R.N. Weybray, in 1987, he argued that of the three possible models, there's also a supplementary hypothesis, a single original book supplemented with later editions, and the fragmentary hypothesis, many fragmentary works and editions, said of the three possible models, the documentary was the most difficult to demonstrate. Yeah. For while the supplemental and fragmentary models propose relatively simple logical processes that could account for the unevenness of the final text, the process envisaged by the documentary hypothesis was both complex and extremely specific in its assumptions about ancient Israel and the development of its religion. Weybray went on to assert that these assumptions were illogical and contradictory. It did not offer real explanatory power. Why, for example, should the authors of the separate sources avoid duplication while the final redactor accepted it? Thus, the hypothesis can only be maintained on the assumption that while consistency was the hallmark of the various source documents, inconsistency was the hallmark of the redactors.
Right.
Which doesn't make sense. Anyway, it's interesting to think about. I can understand. I personally also, and I'm not trying to compare myself to the Rav, but the Rav said these things don't bother him. I'm also not terribly interested in these things. And I think Nechama was interested to the point where she would, quote, someone like Kasuto, but she wasn't going to get into the trenches to try to argue these
issues. I think that's why she didn't like Rabbi Breuer, right? I think because she saw the biblical criticism as this incoherent theory,
right,
and Rabbi Breuer really valued it enough to use it as part of his interpretive process.
And part of the question is, did he do this because, listen, biblical theory is the academic standard, or it was at least, and you know, until relatively recently. And so, if you don't address it, you are an obscurantist. So you have to address it. That's what it's sort of like when the Rambam quotes Aristotle, or Robert Eisen says when the Ralbag quotes Aristotle, who was a bigger Aristotelian than even the Rambam. The reason why they did that was because smart people had to know Aristotle. And if you didn't know Aristotle, you were considered stupid. So it was almost like a chil Hashem for the Torah. In other words, if the only people, and I argue this in terms of general studies of people who are very narrow in terms of their educations, if you don't know, as Rav Lichtenstein always said, the best and the brightest of what was said, he quotes Matthew Arnold, then something is lacking in what you're saying. You are quoting things out of context. So was Breuer motivated by really believing this? Was he saying, you know, this is what we have to deal with, Bizman Hazeh, because this is what is being... I'm having... I don't know if you saw on Facebook, there was an interview with me that was published, it was about my book, etc., that Alan Brill put out. And in it, I mentioned the fact that I went to a conference at Brandeis many years ago, because I'm saying this all started when Dov Weiss, who was at the University of Indiana or Illinois or someplace, he published a book recently about how the perception of God has changed, and you can trace it in the evolution of Midrashim. You can, you know, see how the rabbis became more and more critical of God, etc., which is a good academic discussion. I mean, academicians do that kind of stuff. And I said that, you know, on the one hand, I'd like to know these things, but on the other, I have to limit myself in terms of what I present, because the effects on my students and my congregants are important to me, which is not a concern of academicians. And so at this conference at Brandeis, which was a conference trying to bridge the gap of academia and pedagogy, which I gave a paper at also about teaching difficult passages in the Talmud. So I went to a presentation, I won't say by whom, about a tefillah. And it was a very interesting tefillah. It was very interesting about the sources, how the tefillah evolved. And in the question and answer period, one of the people asked, so how can we incorporate this into our day school things where tefillah is an important experience for the students? And this guy said, and I think he's a religious guy, the effect of my teaching on my students is irrelevant to me. I don't care. That's not my problem. My problem is to say, I don't know, the truth or whatever it is. And I said, I don't have the luxury of doing that. I don't, you know, my job definition is different from that. So in a academic setting, you can put it out there and not necessarily be concerned about the effects that it could have, the religious effects that it could have. That's why I, you know, was going back and forth with you about this. Whereas if you are involved in religious education and you're looking to deal with belief, etc., you do have to be concerned about this. So I said, it's not that you have to change the truth in order to, you know, some people will say that, okay, doctor the stuff up and make it up so that it gets your objective. So change history and change this and change that. I said, I'm not ready to do that. But on the other hand, there might be certain things that I can't talk about because I'm afraid of its effects on, you know, certain individuals.
And or perhaps it's about how you package it.
It's possible, but maybe there are certain things that however you package it, it will have adverse effects. I mean, you know, Alan says that it, you know, he was surprised, but it didn't affect him adversely. I think there are many more people.
I didn't say anything.
Okay, well, I'm putting
just,
words in your mouth.
Remember this.
Yes. But by the way, I think there are many people who it has adversely affected.
No, I realize it's very funny what you said. I mean, very strange, because I realize my memory was not about the first time I heard the documentary hypothesis. Yeah. Now I remember it clearly. It was the first time and place that I heard that there were two Yeshayahus.
Okay, that's what so. That's the
and
beginning.
And it was so powerful.
That's part of the deal, also.
So I'm surprised to hear you say this, because it would seem to me that if you don't teach these things, mm-hmm. information is such these days that students and others are going to hear about them somewhere, somehow. And the fact that you don't teach it, I think, in many ways, suggests to the student when they do hear it. Well, they didn't want to tell me about that.
Right.
Yes, maybe or maybe not. In other words, I think that you have to, you know, sort of weigh what the possibilities are. And, you know, if I would feel sanguine about, you know, someone like Kasuto or whatever, that, oh, these guys have the answers and therefore this is not something to worry about, isn't it possible that there are certain things that people can't handle? Or, for instance, if you're talking about, I don't know, teaching mathematics before you're learning nuclear physics, what are you doing? Do you introduce very sophisticated concepts early on when people don't have the perspective or don't have the knowledge?
But the question is there a value in kids knowing, A, that their Tanakh teachers heard of this stuff, and B, that there are answers out there?
Well, that's what you have to find. So I think that you would have to then, in my opinion, you would have to devote yourself to getting answers that are defensible and that you can present. And quite frankly, I think if you had an indefinite amount of time to teach and to learn, so yes, in other words, this is also, it's like any curriculum, you have to make choices. Seems to me that the more important choice is to try to get people to be committed to these ideas rather than to try to present refutations to the various attacks on the ideas.
So math and nuclear physics really have nothing to do with faith mm-hmm. or belief. So
I'm
not sure those are the best.
But it's complex versus more basic.
But I do think then that it's important, even if you don't delve into those complex or challenging topics, that, as you say, that students need to be aware that scholars grapple with these things and they don't ignore them,
okay.
and don't avoid them, and that there's a time and a place.
Right.
And
so then it becomes a question of degree.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, how
right.
far do you go into it?
Right.
Here's an analogy, a different analogy, that when I was at Ramaz, they wanted me to teach comparative religion, and I didn't want to. Number one, because I said, there's enough in Judaism that I haven't clarified for myself. I don't know if I want to spend the time exploring all these other things. And second of all, let's say I'm going to do a very good job, which is what I do. And a kid says, oh, I like this better than what I have. I would feel a problem. I have aided and abetted. Now, that doesn't mean that they wouldn't have done that anyway, and that I was the... You know, that I was the precipitator, but is that my role? Is that what I should be doing?
That's the question. So you have finally come to say, "Mishtarpt yafun akasha."
For certain kashas, yeah. Yes.
So
it depends on the kasha.
Though, yeah. I think that's different.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly agree about the comparative religion, but I think actually there is an inoculation factor in terms of biblical criticism, exactly because it's the kind of thing that can be very disturbing when students find it out. I would much rather them find it out in a day school setting where they can talk about
right.
it
right.
than in college, right? They're going
right.
to go to college the next year and they're
right.
going to find out about it.
No, I follow that philosophy in lots and lots of areas, but I'm just not sure in this area where I think that part of biblical criticism is debunking. And I think that kids are looking for that because it gives them a certain kind of leverage to say why they don't have to accept upon themselves responsibilities and commitments. I think that is more loaded than simply talking about the different pressures that society will bring to bear in terms of conformity and things like that. Now, I might be wrong, and perhaps you have to deal with this. But then I could see spending an inordinate amount of time on this. In other words, that you're not going to be able to just I don't think if you're dealing with a curious person, you know, could you talk about that a little more? I mean, you know, that's intriguing. Let me understand this. And before you know it, you're going to be spending a very significant amount of time. And so in that respect, what justifies making those kinds of curricular choices?
Because, as you say, it is a very challenging topic. Right. And if they're going to encounter it in an environment where there is no opportunity to hear an appropriate response, then...
Okay.
So I did it as a week-long unit. Mm-hmm.
And no one has said that's not enough, or you're just giving it lip service.
I think that there are kids who are already aware of it. You know, it's like those, the debunking kids, right? They're already aware of it.
Yes.
And the kids who weren't, I don't know, maybe some kids did feel like they needed more, you know, and the truth is you can continue the conversation. You can give kids, mm-hmm. you know, readings if they want to continue it more. Mm-hmm. The two reasons I thought it was important is what I said. One was, that they should know that I heard of it. They shouldn't think like, wow, Mrs. Kostowski never heard of this stuff. She, mm-hmm. you know, this Tanakh teacher. And that they should have, like, they should know that there are, right, that there are people who have, you know, legitimate count, you know, responses to it.
Okay.
My husband once said he wants it to be that when they go to college and the professor says something, hopefully, you know, if the kid comes back to him, you know, and the kid can say, yeah, Rabbi Kosowski said you were going to say that, as opposed to him going, you know, back and that, no, the professor said you were going to say that.
No, know? I did that with Freud and I did that with other things. I don't know, for some reason I was more cautious when it came to stuff like this. But perhaps you're right. And I would, you know, if I were in that situation, I would have to rethink this.
But what would you do if a student came to you with, I heard this, what...
Oh, so then already the cat's out of the bag. Then you have no choice. But the question is whether you precipitate these things. In other words, does this become a, you know, formal part of the study? Anyway, if we go on in the Alon HaDracha, she writes, and here I think there's something missing in the Alon HaDracha, even with what I filled in. Ne'ayin ashav im v'ad kama matimim haktuvim leklalim halalu. Let's check whether the verses really work with Kasuto's rules. Sheyatsu lanu mitoch mechkarenu, that emerges from our research.
You're on page 6.
Okay. Yes. Im yatimu tishamesh hatamazu hochacha v'ishur l'nechonot maskonoteinu. So if we can show that it's reinforced, that in fact it's consistent, so then this is a proof to the hypothesis. As I said before, you have to test the hypothesis. This is how you test the hypothesis. Okay, Kasuto, you're giving me these rules. Let me plug them in and let me see if they work. V'tarshelanu l'hagia, and it allows us to reach, v'zechashuv biyoter, that's very important, lidei birur hata'amim shel chiluf hashemot. So that's the next step. In other words, first you have the rules, but the rules are mufshat. They are sort of abstracted. They're not in the application in verses. If I see them work in the verses, I can draw conclusions as to why was this name chosen in this case and that name chosen in that case. Muvan hadavar shebemeshech hartza'azu. So that's what I don't understand. A hartza'ah is a lecture.
Yeah, so it sounds like she must have lectured about this once and stuck it into the
Gila. Exactly. That's very striking to me. Lo yiyeh efshar lanu livdok et kol ha-parshiyot ha-sipuriyot shebetorah. We're not going to be able to check all of the parshiyot in the Torah where there are stories. V'aflo et kol sefer breishit mitchilato v'yad sofo. We don't even have time to do all of breishit from the beginning to the end. Lefichach nitztarech listapek bedugmaot. We're going to have to take examples. V'ulam, b'chdei shenuchal la'agia lidei hochacha machra'at, in order to be able to reach a definite conclusion, lo nivchar et dugmatenu mimkomot shonim po v'sham. We're not going to just take examples here and there. Ela natchil et bdikatenu mitchilat sefer breishit. We'll start at the beginning, from the beginning of breishit. V'nam shichena kefi seder haktuvim b'lishum dilug. And we're not going to skip anything. Ad shiyera el lanu shekvar yesh bakamam sheyaspik lahasik mimenu maskanot betuchot. Until we can get to conclusions that are absolute and firm.
And then we don't have them.
And we don't have them. So chaval.
No. I think she's saying that that's impossible. Therefore, the theory fails.
No.
Oh, she didn't say that.
So. It sounds to me like it's her introductory paragraph from a lecture that she gave somewhere.
Right. And she gave examples trying to apply the various principles.
The truth is, it does work. If you look at everything Kasuto says and you do start going through Rishit and applying it, you can find a lot of places where it works.
Okay. Anyway, the next point that she makes is interesting because it's one of the things that, again, the documentary hypothesis uses in order to demonstrate that the Torah was written at different times. So she writes, L'sheila Gimel 2, Efshar l'hashvot et divrei Rashi l'dvarim lamed bet memchet dibar amatchil v'daber Hashem el Moshe be'etzem hayom hazeh. So this Rashi, she mentions the Gilayon ha'azinu, that's the thing that I asked Beth to send out today. So here is the Gilayon ha'azinu, which has the full Rashi that she is referencing here. And it has to do with the phrase be'etzem hayom hazeh, on this very day. So Ne'emar b'Noach, be'etzem hayom hazeh ba Noach el ha'teva. On this very day, Noach comes to the ark. Be'marit oro shel yom. It was during daylight. Lefi shayu b'nei doro omrim, because the members of his generation would say, be'kach v'kach, im anu margishim bo, ein anu menichim oto likanes b'teva. Oh, we're not going to let him go into the ark. V'lo od ela anu notlim keshilin v'kardumot u'mavkin et ha'teva. And we're going to take implements and break apart the teva. So in other words, it's sort of like, some people explain, this is why Chava gave the fruit to Adam. If I go down, you're going to go down too. I'm not going to be the only one, right? So, you know, if the flood's going to drown us, well, Noah's going to drown too. Nobody's going to survive.
I kind of wondered about that.
Yeah. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hareini machniso b'chatzi ayom. You know what? I'm not going to sneak him in. He's going to walk in noontime, high noon, when everyone can see. Let someone try to stop it. Next case. B'mitzrayim. Ne'emar be'etzem hayom hazeh, on this very day. Hotzi Hashem et b'nei Yisrael mi'eretz Mitzrayim. Right? That God took b'nei Yisrael out of Egypt. L'vishayu mitzrim omrim b'kach v'kach imanu margishim b'hem einanu menichim otam latzeit. If they try to make a move, we're not going to let them leave. Sounds very similar, very parallel to the case of Noah. We're going to kill them rather than let them leave. See if you can stop me. Afkan b'mitato shel Moshe. So this is where the Rashi appears. The death of Moshe. Ne'amar be'etzem hayom hazeh, on this very day. L'fishayu Yisrael omrim b'kach v'kach im anu margishim bo ein anu menichim oto. We don't want to let Moshe go. We're not going to allow him to die. Adam shotzianu mimitzrayim v'karalanu et hayam v'horid lanu et haman v'giz lanu et haslav v'helal lanu et habe'er. He did all this great stuff for us. V'natan lanu et haTorah ein anu menichim oto. We're not going to let him leave. We need him. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu areini machniso b'chatzi hayom. Oh yes, yeah. Just you wait. Just you wait and see. Right, Hari Machniso bechatzi hayom lema'ara into a cave. V'cholam v'cheinomar v'cholmi sheyesh biyado limchot yavo v'imcha. So let's see if someone can stop it. L'chach ne'amar v'deber Hashem Moshe be'etzem hayom hazeh lemor. So on that very day. So she says, Rav Natan Shapiro, one of the commentators on Rashi, Imre Shefer writes, Lo yadati lama eno moneh rak shlosha makomot halalu, v'lo gam ba'avraham ne'emar be'etzem hayom hazeh. Talking about the Brit Milah, right? Uperish Rashi sham, bo b'yom shenitztaveh. He was zrizim makdim le'mitzvot. As soon as he was commanded, Avraham carried this out, even though it must have been very difficult. B'yom v'lo b'layla, and he did in the daytime, not at night. Lo nityare, lo min ha'goyim, v'lo min ha'leitzanim. He wasn't afraid of the nations. He wasn't afraid of the scoffers. Shelo yu oivav v'nei doro omrim. He doesn't want his enemies and his peers to say, ilu reinuhu lo hinichuhu lamul. If we had seen him thinking about doing this, we wouldn't have allowed it. U'lekayim mitzvato shel makom. Which seems fairly parallel to the other three. And then she gives the response of Shmuel HaTzarfati Mipaz, Nemuke Shmuel. Vani mosif od liyashev lamar deshapir matzinu lechalek deshani hanitlat, that the first three are different. Me etzem hayom de Avraham, from Avraham's case. Bechulam amar Rashi lefi shayu omrim. In other words, that people in general would say, Avol be'etzem hayom hazed Avraham lo amar Rashi zal ela shalo yu oivav uvnei doro omrim. It's not so specific. It's not like every last person would say it. It's people who have a personal issue or personal vendetta with Avraham, or the people who are his contemporaries, the people who know him immediately. Lo amar lefisha yu omrim. Imkain lo damu hadada dadi. So therefore, they're not similar. Lachain lo mana Rashi zal el shloshim makomot halala. Seems like a very technical reason. In other words, one is more general than the other, and therefore we're not going to equate them. In her question, she said, "Hatuchali ashevet kushat bal imre shefer," and I think what I wanted to suggest was that the case of Mila only applied to Avram. Mila wasn't something that Avram was insisting other people do. Granted, within his household, he needed to. That was God's order, but. If he does Milo, it doesn't mean that anybody else in the vicinity has to, which as opposed to the three examples, the three other examples have an effect on others. If Noah escapes, if the Jews escape, if Moshe goes away, so this isn't only something that is shayach to those particular individuals, it's going to have repercussions with regard to other people as well. And so perhaps... You know, that's a concern, although I don't know. I mean, again, maybe the question is better than the answer.
Well, it's also the initiative of the three examples that Rashi lists first are Hashem. In other words, yeah. Hashem is saying, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make this happen, as opposed to it seems with Avram that Avram is taking the initiative, that he's not afraid.
Although the only reason why Avram does it is because God told him, and I don't think Avram would do it on his own.
Right, but in other words, in these three, it's this, you other people think you have power over God, you do not have power over God, right? Mm-hmm. That's a little bit of a different message than Avram Avinu was not afraid of the repercussions of what he was going to do.
But they thought they had power over Avraham, who was carrying out God's decree.
Right, but in other words, it's not so much Hashem saying like go ahead try. It's Avram saying go ahead try.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, I don't know. It's not clear. I mean, she just as her want, she just asked the question. Meanwhile, this ad hayom hazeh, where right, it says that Hobbes in the Leviathan cited several passages, such as Dvarim 34:6, no man knows of his sepulcher to this day. Ad hayom, I'm reading now the doctorant hypothesis thing. You don't have it. I this is only I printed out for myself, implying an author living long after Moses' death. Ad etza hayom has until this very day, nobody knows. So that's a different reading of this, of the terminology. But meanwhile, wherever it says until today, the name of this place until today is such and such. Oh, until today is different than from the events that were being recorded. Perhaps there is some sort of gap in regard to who has recorded this. So that's sort of, I think, and so in effect, indirectly. She's still dealing with these issues. In other words, that these are also questions along the same, along the same lines.
No, I don't think these go away.
No, they don't. But this whole Gilayon seems to be pervaded with these kinds of things. And the last issue about the laughter, the biblical critics will say that these are two different accounts of story. There's laughter here and there's laughter there. Are they necessarily the same story? Is it, the Rav said, chapter 1 and chapter 2 of Bereishit are different points of different perspectives, the same writers giving different perspectives. That's a sophisticated literary approach already. I mean, do you assume that those are the kinds of things that are, that are happening here?
I think that's part of the difference between biblical criticism and not accepting it, is there's an assumption of a very primitive nature of the authors of the Bible, if you're a Bible critic, as opposed to our assumption that there's very sophisticated
Correct.
Ideas being presented in Tanakh.
You're already giving it like a negative spin. I would say you could take those two categories and express it in a more parav way, not you, and that is to say, when we encounter a contradiction in the text, we say, well, it's not a contradiction here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu means so-and-so, and the other place HaKadosh Baruch Hu means this other thing. But But that's a very from perspective. A regular person, a non-from person, starts out thinking this is written by a man or by men or by women. It's written by people. And if you have a contradiction, it doesn't necessarily mean that the divine author means two different things to mm-hmm. teach you.
I think it was a very negative thing. I think it was Germans who are anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish.
Why do you say
well, that was Nahama's point of view.
Historically, yeah. It was. Oh, I really okay. think that.
But
and
would you grant that it could also be that same theory and not
that's more of Heidegger's point
of view. In other words, yes, like now, but in other words, it was started very much as an anti-Jewish campaign. And people
let's
now
say
are
anti-Semitic.
I think anti-religious say, campaign. Right.
Right. Not anti-Semitic.
Because the scientific...
Well, yes, also a lot of Germans. A lot of
I know. It's true. But religion was perceived as right. superstition
right.
and anti-science.
Right.
And therefore...
And
not just the Jewish religion.
And
exactly.
And they were assuming a very primitive nature to...
And this is
to
the debunking idea.
Right, it's a very different perspective on what Tanakh is.
Let me finish with one of the views about the laughter, because that's, I think, really interesting. And so first she quotes Ibn Kaspi, who has a longer discussion of this than Rav Yitzchak Avramo, the Pachad Yitzchak, so I'd rather do that. So on the third page, it's the section immediately before the Alon Hadracha of the Gilayon. So here's Rav Yitzchak Avramo. Again, the question is, it seems that the laughter of Avram and the laughter of Sarah is the same, and yet Sarah is criticized much more sharply than Avraham is. Avram's not criticized at all. It would seem. Well, yes, we are. Yes, to some extent. Well, these are politics that have existed, unfortunately, throughout. I mean, there was one of my former students from Ramaz wrote an opinion column in the foreword saying that this woman who came forward about Avi Shavit, you know, made her think about all of the times when it's her life as a woman. And I wrote to her, I said, I'm really sorry, you know, and she talked about on the subway to Ramaz and in college and in this and in that. And I said, you know, I feel bad that you've gone through all of this. And I hope that, you know, things, and she said, I have to worry about my daughters. And she said, well, at least people are talking about it now. And I wrote back, I'm not sure that the people who are talking about it, that message will necessarily get through to those people who are abusers or whatever. And so, you know, the question is, what does it take to make a sea change within the society? And I think that that's a very important idea. Anyway, so, but you're right. It would seem like this is a sexist kind of a response. Im banu bi'ikvut harishonim lahafrish bein tzchok letzchok. If we try to distinguish between one laughter and another, ulai amtsik satam ledivrehem. So if we assume that the two laughters were different, maybe we can justify this a little. Amnam ledati ein litchok b'chol zeh, rak sheyaforshu haktuvim kipshutan. I don't think it's necessary to strain this. I think you can explain the verses according to their literal meaning. U'bedavar hazeh nimtza bo, Gamkein alava shalom shemetz avon umiut emuna. She says, why do you think that Avram is being let off the hook? Avram is also doing the wrong thing. Al derech shamar Moshe Rabbeinu hatzon ubakar yishachet lahem umatzal lahem. Remember when Moshe was saying, how am I going to, you mean you're going to be able to provide enough meat for these people who are complaining? Implying, what's the matter, Moshe? You don't think God can do that? I mean, it implies that Moshe also had little faith. According to the Midrashim, God should have responded very sharply. But it was a day of information. There are times when God has ample justification to react very strongly, but chooses not to because he doesn't want to associate that particular occasion with punishment or negativity, which doesn't mean that negativity didn't happen, but rather it wasn't appropriate for punishment. Bo nitna lo mitzvah rabba shel mila lo ulbanav besimcha. if God would yell at Abraham and at the same time command the mitzvah of Milah, there would be this negative association between Milah and God's rebuke. Ukvar irak inyan hazeh biyom matan Torah. She asks what the reference is. The reference, it seems to me, is in chapter 24 when it says that the Atzilei Bnei Yisrael were seeing God and eating and drinking and nothing happened to them. Nothing happened to them then. But some people say that what happened to Nadav and Avihu eventually, as well as the Kenim, happened later, that they were punished for what had happened. It's just that God felt that the timing of associating the deaths of these people with Matan Torah would have been a bad idea.
So it's okay for opening day of the Mishkan.
Yes, and the Mishnah and the Torah Tmima says, I was looking for the reference in my essay, but I couldn't find it, that the problem with the Mishkan is now people will say, oh, if we do a mistake, we can bring a korban and everything will be fine. Not so fast. Now, I don't think that God is a vatran. And so here's Nadav and Avihu playing fast and loose with the Mishkan. God is not going to just let that happen. And there are all these different explanations. They were drunk, they were this, they were that. Anyway. V'chein ha'davar b'kan b'sara. So this is what's true here too. Lo ratza HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'hatzivo b'divrei tochachot b'yom chatunato. So God didn't want to cloud this day with tochachot, with rebukes. V'shamar lo l'yom shlishi l'milato yom pkudat sara. So he put it off until later, the third day. Remember that when did the guys come? He was 3 days after the Milah. So if you assume that he did the Milah immediately after he was told, then that means that the angels came 3 days later, and that's when Sarah was informed. So the two events happened relatively close to one another. Ki galui lefanav, ki kemikre hazakein, gam hi ikra la. The same thing that would happen to Avram would happen to her. Just like Avram scoffed, she would scoff as well. V'daylo az ga'ara b'mevin kama shochicha al yado. And when Avraham hears how Sarah is rebuked, he will take it to heart himself as well. That's rather interesting, I thought. The Moshe Ne'emar, v'yomer Hashem el Avraham, lama zet zachacha Sarah. And notice, it's not that Sarah was confronted privately. Avraham said, how come Sarah is laughing? Hint, hint, hint. Who else laughed? You know, this is about you as well. Hayipole me Hashem davar? What? God can't do what he promises to do. Ubalav hachi, v'ilulei sheratza lochiach gam et Avraham. If he didn't want to also rebuke Avraham, lama lo yochicha al paneha beina lebeina. So why didn't he rebuke her privately without Avraham's knowledge? V'alo ga'ara b'fnei ba'ala yoter meguneh Mimasha Amrush in his harba chiluf hadvarim ibnei darchei shalom. We say that to keep peace between husband and wife, and this is the whole thing about they asked Avram, why did she say that she's old when she really said both he and she is old? Oh, so that's darchei shalom. So that I care about. Well, embarrassing a wife in front of her husband, that's going to contribute to shalom? Obviously not. So why was that not a concern? Because Avraham was being rebuked also indirectly through the rebuke that's extended to Sarah. I still have a problem with that. I still think that Sarah is the brunt of this. In other words, that Avraham gets off with a subtle rebuke and Sarah gets the sharp rebuke, even though Rav Yitzchak Rama wants to say that both of them were equally culpable, that both of them were equally guilty. So once again, you know, you're not going to... No answer is a perfect answer. Every answer is going to be lacking, but it's still interesting to see the insight. In the last line, he writes, "Karata et shmo Yitzchak lezikaron shetzachakta alav liyot davar nifla beinecha." So, a second rebuke that is going to go on throughout Yitzchak's life is that every time he refers to Yitzchak, he will recall how he laughed, and that was something that was not right. So in other words, it's not a laughter of joy, etc. It's an ongoing rebuke, an ongoing, you know, challenge to what Avraham had done. V'zohi tchilat, and here it goes away. Tchilat something.
Yeah,
tochacha. Tochacha, okay, right. Tochacha at the beginning of a rebuke. So I thought, it's very creative. That's
like you said, if you really wanted there to be no question, Hashem would have had to say to Avram, why did you and Sarah laugh?
Exactly.